This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Get the accelerator. The place is underwater, but you say, hit the accelerator.
When disaster strikes and governments can't help, people boil over. From Athens, we talk with foreign correspondent and climate security analyst Peter Schwartzstein. His new book is The Heat and the Fury on the Front Lines of Climate Violence. Then, why are scientists still talking about 1.5 degrees of warming as the goal when last year was already hotter than that? We ask leading researcher Christoph Bertram to explain his team's more realistic take. Meanwhile, Appalachia and Nepal are reeling from city-breaking floods. Las Vegas is still sinfully hot in October. Sorry, United Kingdom, you drew the never-ending rain card in the climate casino. Who's next? I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Can climate extremes drive unrest, riots, or revolutions? A journalist with years in the world's hotspots just published the new book, In the Heat and the Fury, on the Front Lines of Climate Violence. Our guest is author Peter Schwartzstein. Peter is a widely published journalist and environmental consultant for a number of big-name UN and aid agencies. After 5 years reporting from Cairo, and then 10 traveling around the Middle East, he is a research fellow for the Nonpartisan Center for Climate and Security and a global fellow with Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. Peter Schwartzstein, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Delighted to be here.
When first presented with the idea of climate and violence, I thought of crime rates going up in the big cities during hot, humid days and nights. But this book is not about that. How would you introduce the theme of your new book?
This book is an attempt to lay out, particularly to the casual reader, but not just, the extent of violence that climate change is already fueling globally, but also the precise nature of that violence. I mean, a lot of the time, even among friends of mine engaged in other parts of the climate discourse, there can be a tendency to think of climate-related violence as some sort of hypothetical future threat. And what I've tried to do through these many years of reporting and through these sort of 300-odd pages is to illustrate that this is very much a problem in the here and the now.
In 2015, climate scientist Colin Kelly published a paper in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. They found climate change doubled or even tripled the likelihood of the severe drought that occurred in Syria from 2006 to 2010. That, they say, set the stage for the Syrian Revolution of 2011, their Arab Spring. Does your experience on the ground in Syria support that climate connection?
It does. I mean, for any of your listeners that are perhaps heard of the kind of climate security field, as it's most commonly known, it is perhaps kind of in the context of Syria. And I mean, I'm sort of just to take a sort of brief step back. From about 2013 onwards, the early-ish years of the war, there was a kind of tremendous sort of back and forth in certain parts of the scholarly community about the extent to which climate change contributed to the hostilities that triggered the initial revolution. Yeah, off the back of my years' worth of work in Syria and many of its neighbors, I fall very much on the side of the fence suggesting that climate played a relatively significant role. That said, I suggest that climate's contribution was perhaps a little bit different than that espoused by many of my scholar colleagues. One of my big takeaways off the back of this 11, 12 years worth of groundwork is that we're underestimating the nature of climate change's contribution to violence because we're not fully factoring in how climate change is acting on other drivers of instability, such as corruption, such as misinformation, such as inequality. And in the case of Syria, you had many of these farmers who had to contend with years, I mean decades worth of bribe-seeking demands from agricultural and other officials at the time when kind of climate-related drought was massively depleting their yields and shrinking their already pretty miserly-looking incomes. the very fact that these officials were coming back to them with those same corrupt bribe-seeking demands was something of a bridge too far. They simply couldn't afford this even less than they could in times of superior agriculture. All of which is to say, yes, there was a very definitive climate component.
As you know, two social scientists and an environmental statistician argued there was no clear link between climate change and the uprisings in Syria. Professor Jan Selby at the University of Sussex found, quoting him, no sound evidence that global climate change was a factor in sparking the Syrian civil war, end quote. They don't discount a climate link. They just say it's so complex you can't find the signal. And I think it was just an early call. And as we get more extreme events, we're going to have more test cases. Where else did you find links between climate changes and violence?
So, I mean, this book is sort of an exploration through nine stories, nine case studies, one set primarily in Sudan, one set primarily in about four or five different countries of Africa's Sahel region, one in Jordan, one in Iraq, one in Bangladesh, and so on. I mean, to pick you up on the Bangladesh one for a moment, it was while I was working in a very peripheral, out-of-the-way coastal parts of Bangladesh that I, in a completely unsolicited manner, came across many of these fishermen who were being kidnapped on an extremely regular basis by pirates, by these sort of bandits that kind of ply those jungle inland waterways. And the more that I kind of dug into this issue over the course of a number of trips to that part of Bangladesh, the more that I came to understand that there was a pretty strong climate component to this cycle of violence. Like basically, due to sea level rise and an array of other climate and wider environmental troubles, large numbers of farmers are being displaced from their land. And the only, in their case at least, sort of viable local financial alternative is to turn to fishing. And basically, the more that the number of fishermen increases in those jungle waterways, the greater the volume of pirates, many of whom derive their living from kidnapping for ransom these any unfortunate villagers that cross their path. And just as the volume of lucre increases, more and more of these criminals are willing to deal with the unpleasant living conditions that come with coastal piracy.
So when rains don't come or floods wipe out a planting, how can agricultural failures help radical groups like ISIS?
A lot of it is to do with the kind of immiseration and poverty, which a lot of the time can give something of an opening for these occasionally well-resourced non-state armed groups or jihadists like ISIS to kind of step into the brink. But even more of it is not so much related to an increase in poverty. We know that immiseration is absolutely no kind of straightforward leap to any form of kind of criminality or violence. But when people feel that their government is not coming to their aid or is abandoning them or is distributing assistance inequitably at their time of greatest need, and that can contribute to pretty intense degrees of resentment, which many of these jihadist groups, in the case of ISIS, are pretty well practiced in harnessing.
Peter, what do you see as misinformation on the subject of climate and violence?
Well, I mean, there's sort of a few different ways to approach that. First of all, we have a lot of misinformation within these conflict climate settings, which is exacerbating the degree of violence. So, for example, if we look at the farmer-herder violence, which is mushrooming across large parts of the African Sahelian region, a lot of it is propelled by online fake news of the sort that kind of thrives in settings where authorities are kind of weak and distrusted. So, for example, a lot of the same herder, same ethnic groups from which many of the herders are drawn from are at least partly involved in various forms of kind of terrorist or jihadi activity in that part of the world too. However, there's been a lot of either accidental or kind of willful attempts online to present these jihadi groups as being almost entirely constituted full of herders or people drawn from kind of herding-centric ethnic backgrounds. And that kind of conflation has really contributed to even more intense levels of kind of anti-herder sentiment and the kind of privileging of farmer interests over those of the herders.
Well, maybe the case for climate and violence is more regional. I mean, we don't expect riots or attempts to overthrow the government from the disaster-torn Appalachia after the hurricane. They know help is coming. But there was a massive heat wave in May of 2023 in Sri Lanka, and the starving people there, who had a lot of other difficulties, knew no help was coming from their bankrupt government, and that is when it boiled over into an uprising. Your thoughts, Peter?
Two things here. First of all, you're quite right that most of this kind of violence, most of this violence that's emerging in part out of climate change, is indeed something that we're seeing in poorer parts of the world. But as we perhaps can get into a little bit later, and as I sort of try and tilt that in the latter chapters of the book, we are seeing variations of climate-related violence beginning to play out in our own kind of richer parts of the world, too. So it's a little bit of a kind of watch this space. But as for the Sri Lanka situation, yeah, it's when you have the sense among people that they're living in hopeless situations, that they're living in circumstances where due to either climate stresses or a whole bundle of other kind of unrelated issues, that the future holds very little in the way of promise, that's where you quite often get these sort of wild, possibly irrational, kind of misdirected kinds of rage that so often kind of burst out in revolutionary scenarios. People are often acutely aware that rising up and burning police stations or kind of expressing themselves in various ways is exceedingly unlikely to lead to superior outcomes in the future. But when you're as bedraggled and as beaten down by your circumstances, a lot of the time you're not really thinking about the future. You're more propelled by a sense of desperation and kind of a desire for revenge against targets, kind of clear-cut and others.
So the United Nations just warned again about increasing violence against women after disaster strike. Women are forced to move with their families, sometimes into shelters or camps. They become targets. We are just sorting out the aftermath of Hurricane Helene, but with so few homes insured, there's bound to be loss and social stress. I wonder, does your book consider when violence is not visible social unrest, but hidden violence at home?
I do indeed. I do in a number of parts of the book look at violence against women, who, as you very correctly identify, quite often suffer first and suffer most at times of climate stress. And again, this is very much not just a poor part of the world phenomenon. I mean, in the aftermath of Hurricane Beryl in Texas in June, July, there was an enormous uptick in calls to women's shelters in the Houston area. So I do look quite a lot at some of the slightly more nebulous forms of instability that are arising in part out of climate change. And by that, I mean things like the deterioration or the decrease in perceived legitimacy of many states that are struggling to deal with climate stresses. So, for example, when you have governments, as in large parts of Africa, as in Nepal, in the case of the example that I arrow in on the book, when these authorities are kind of systematically failing for these large climate-related reasons to provide sufficient freshwater access, sufficient sewage disposal, at least satisfactorily good infrastructure, a lot of the time that's going to kind of blow back in the form of quite fierce degrees of anti-state sentiment. So if we look at, for example, this epidemic of military coups across parts of West and Central Africa over the past year or two, I would argue that the very fact that so many of these often rogue or roguish kind of generals and colonels have been able to launch these assaults on either democratically elected or non-democratically elected civilian governments with tremendous popular support is a reflection of the extremely broad degree of unpopularity that these authorities have brought upon themselves, in part due to their failure to provide those most basic of services. So this is, to my mind, the real coming storm, and one that threatens countries that go beyond perhaps the usual suspects.
Yes, what does your book have to say to readers in the United States, Canada, or the UK, or even Australia, about why we should care about this issue? Maybe this is something that happens to other people first.
It does indeed happen to other people first. I mean, the reason why most of the book is focused on the experience of poorer countries is that climate-related violence is almost always a marriage of climate stresses and poor governance, and both of those phenomena manifest themselves most obviously in poorer places. But first of all, as we ought to have learned with the migration crisis, with varying degrees of terrorism and other troubles over the years, crises in one place do not remain sort of little self-contained disasters. They explode outwards. So the more that kind of poorer parts of the world with a kind of lesser ability to adapt to climate stresses, the more that they suffer from these kinds of violence as described throughout the book, the more that we too will suffer the fallouts and perhaps the uptick in populist politics that tends to thrive off threat or perceived threat around our peripheries. But to go back to what I was saying about violence against women, bit by bit, as our own climatic conditions and in some instances perhaps our own degrees of governance come to resemble those of poorer parts of the world, we too are starting to experience forms of climate-related violence. I mentioned, again, violence against women, but a kind of moderately less tragic example for the time being, but one that might form something of an eerie prelude to what we might see much more of in the future. In Greece, where I live, there's been an absolutely huge increase in the price of olive oil over the past 2 or 3 years, in large part due to climate-induced drought in Spain, Italy, Greece, the countries that produce most of that commodity globally. And the higher that the prices go, the more incentivized that criminals, including quite a lot of organized crime outfits, are to target olive oil depots and even some olive trees themselves. And there's been this massive surge in theft of large quantities of olive oil because people are now sufficiently incentivized by that high price to turn to new forms of crime.
Radio EcoShock, Alex talks with climate security author Peter Schwartzstein.
And you became a non-resident fellow with the Center for Climate and Security in Washington, but this is almost a new field, the climate security expert. As records for extreme weather continue to be smashed all over the world, what is climate security?
Oof, that's a difficult question. You're right to say that this is a relatively new field, certainly one that's sort of growing at a pretty swift trot over the course of the last few years. But part of it comes with sort of trying to recognize how, the biggest part of it comes with recognizing how intimately connected climate stress and security are. So this can take the form of the kind of work that I do, just trying to illustrate how much violence globally is already being caused by climate-related stresses. Equally, it can take the form of trying to kind of better safeguard militaries to deal with the complications that climate change will pose for their own operations, for their own infrastructure, for their own capacity to effectively operate in different landscapes. And it can also mean everything from ensuring that regular communities, as with many of those affected by Hurricane Helene in the southeast of the U.S., are better prepared for the humanitarian and development and at the moment even aid consequences that come with intense climate stress.
Well, I wonder, do you think the Pentagon or the German Federal Ministry of Defense have in-house experts on climate security now?
They very much do. I mean, in the case of the Pentagon, the Navy especially has a very strong claim to having been one of the first institutions globally to recognize the full extent of climate change's contribution to infrastructure destruction, but also of the many different ways in which this is going to affect them down the line. And that a lot of that's kind of grounded in pretty massive budgets that these forces often have. But a lot of the time that's because they are strategic planners. They understand that they need to assess both current and future threats to their capacity to perform any manner of functions. And the more they've done this work, the more concerned they've become.
Well, repeated climate disasters not only cost lives, they tear away infrastructure built over decades. We certainly saw that in the Appalachians. What can be done to help stable societies and governments survive and keep on operating even during greater climate changes to come?
I try to kind of keep a little bit of a kind of sort of optimistic subtext to a lot of the book. And that key bit of sort of relative optimism is that most of the violence that I describe in the book is not inevitable. Like, this doesn't have to happen. It most certainly doesn't have to happen on the scale that is probable if we continue to allow warming to kind of continue at its current trot. In a way, the profoundly unhelpful, almost trite-sounding response is we just need much more meaningful climate action. With every kind of small incremental increase beyond the 1.2 or so degrees Celsius that we've warmed thus far, it becomes that bit harder to maintain viable communities in which agriculture can allow hundreds of millions of people to live, or at least prosper. It becomes that bit harder to gird governments and rural and even some urban communities for the extreme weather events coming their way. So, I mean, this boils down to an extremely familiar refrain. We need to wean ourselves off oil and gas as swiftly as possible for reasons of violence prevention, amongst so many others.
We talk about institutions. You are one of the few with one-on-one contact with real people on the harsh side of climate change. Tell us a couple of human stories from your book on the front lines of climate violence.
So a lot of the work that I've done, or perhaps the country in which I've done the most of my work, has been in Iraq since about 2013. And that's because I was doing years' worth of work trying to better explore how ISIS profited from collapsing agricultural conditions to bolster its ranks. And I interviewed quite a few captured ISIS prisoners of war, an inordinate number of whom had been farmers from some of the kind of most drought-battered expanses of Iraq and Syria. And one of these individuals in particular spun this sort of long, self-serving, but as far as I could see, essentially accurate tale about how, as drought conditions kind of replicated themselves year after year, and as his sort of anger at government increased due to his perception that it really ought to be helping him at his and his family's time of greatest need, it really only came to that point where he was just fishing around desperately for any kind of alternative at a time where he felt the Iraqi authorities had sort of abrogated their right to govern in his particular kind of climate-battered part of the country. Equally, in the Sahel, this other large part of Africa in which I do a lot of work, I've encountered so many of these farmers and herders who are kind of competing for scarcer degrees of kind of adequate pasture land. And for many of them, most of them, they really don't want to fight. I mean, despite the sort of misinformation that I invoked earlier, a lot of them do look at one another as sort of friendly peers. But circumstances are such, along with strong degrees of poor governance, that circumstances really are pitching them against one another. And this is just a tale that we're seeing more and more from pole to pole.
And what are you working on these days?
Well, I'm sort of busily whoring myself out trying to get the book out there. I mean, to my mind, there's very little point spending this volume of time writing a book if I can't get it in front of people who are hopefully in positions to do something about it. So to that end, I've done a large number of briefings to different U.S. government officials and yesterday and the day before to their U.N. equivalents in various agencies in New York, and I'll be doing something similar in parts of Europe for much of the month of November. But thereafter, much of my work has taken me to very hot, often arid parts of the world. And particularly when I've been working on challenging, quite sort of psychologically taxing issues, I've kind of forever retreated to mountains as a way of sort of doing my writing, kind of restoking my batteries ahead of the next kind of delve into a sort of challenging landscape. So I'd like to kind of write something, either a novel, though despite writing as a living, creative writing is such a different animal that I have absolutely no idea how to go about that, or perhaps a kind of non-fiction book centered on the ways in which mountains are changing in a kind of more climate-battered future.
Well, as the climate heats up, both people and plants and animals are going to be moving up into higher altitudes, into the mountains, so that's going to change that whole dynamic as well.
Very possibly. But then again, and as you know well, I mean, to look at some of the worst destruction that Hurricane Helene left in its wake, a good chunk of it was in the kind of mountainous parts of western North Carolina. I mean, areas around Asheville that were quite frequently described by various U.S. magazines as a sort of possible climate haven away from coastlines that were perceived to be that bit more vulnerable. And as we are seeing, mountain ecology is by its very nature acutely vulnerable to even small changes, and really perhaps hammers home what so many of us suspect, which is that there will be very few, if any, sort of genuine havens if warming continues at its current trot. So this is a problem that must be addressed head on. There's simply no running away from it.
From the Center for Climate and Security and the Wilson Center, we've been speaking with climate security journalist and advisor Peter Schwartzstein. And you can travel with him to dangerous places in his new book, In the Heat and the Fury, on the Front Lines of Climate Violence. Find my notes and links to follow up in my blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Find Peter at pschwartzstein.com. Peter, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
When it comes to climate, the mountains have always been an attractive place to live, and now even more so with climate change making severe weather events even worse elsewhere. Climate change leading to climate migration.
Weather events are becoming crazy all over the world, and there's places where they're less crazy. Asheville's fortunate to be one of those places.
Now more people taking refuge in the temperate mountains of western North Carolina. This real estate broker is saying he's hearing that climate is a big reason why people are moving here.
I think people have noticed and are moving here to escape wildfires, to escape floods, to escape hurricanes, to escape droughts.
Scott Shuford is a local expert in community planning and resilience.
Our big three issues of climate change affecting North Carolina are sea level rise, which clearly we're not having a problem with that, but also heavy precipitation and periods of drought.
He says those don't affect us in Asheville as much since we're far from the coast, have the North Fork Reservoir for our water supply, and the elevation to keep our temperatures mild. Not immune to climate change, of course, just less susceptible. And he doesn't think we're anywhere near the peak of climate migration.
This is one of the most ironic clips ever. WLOS 13, Asheville's ABC affiliate, ran that piece on why Asheville is safe from climate change. It was in April 2022. At the end of September, 2 years later, Asheville was partially destroyed and cut off from the world by the tail end of Hurricane Helene. There are no havens from climate change, you know that. You may lose life expectancy inhaling wildfire smoke from fires thousands of miles away. Or you may be evacuated suddenly and shocking when it comes to you. This is why all of us, young and old, urgently need to become climate communicators and activists. We will be right back with answers to the infernal question, why are scientists still talking as though limiting warming to 1.5 degrees C is possible? Time for climate news tidbits. If you are in Vancouver October 16th to 18th, drop by the 2024 Coal Association of Canada Conference. Their slogan is, Canada has what the world wants. Climate-killing coal, I presume. They have charts and experts to show expanding populations around the world need more Canadian coal. You can even learn how Canada expanded two coal ports in Vancouver to ship coal from the open pits of the Powder River Basin in Wyoming on Warren Buffett's coal trains. Seattle and the other U.S. coast cities refused that dirty business. Coal is not fading away, no matter what you hear. Global coal prices and production are up. I'm sure the industry is happy to stay out of the limelight as continuing disasters strike, due in large part to the coal industry over the last 200 years. Hey, Vancouver, time to turn out on coal again. A new study finds about 40% of the public supports rationing measures to fight climate change. Well, sure, maybe in Sweden, where the study came from Uppsala University. Actually, they say the new study involved 9,000 people in Brazil, India, Germany, South Africa, and the United States. This is surprising. It turns out millions and millions of people are already deeply worried about climate change. They're willing to help, maybe even give up a little, but only if the system is fair to everyone, not just the 1%. You can find a link to that in my blog.
And rising waters in the dark. Hold on tight, tight. Hold on, thousand. Hold on, thousand deep. Hold on, star in the sky. Hold on, 2 years.
the
roll
on into
roll on.
This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Burning questions in advance. In a world of chaos we cannot see, we turn to machines, begging on our knees. Artificial savior, when will you save us?
Scientists say 1.5 degrees C of warming beyond pre-industrial is a red line for preventing more climate chaos than we've already seen. But the last 12 months were 1.64 degrees C above pre-industrial. With 1.5 in the rearview mirror, why are scientists still talking about 1.5 as though it were a real target? We are about to ask a lead researcher in the field that very question. A new study confirms what we all feared. Global warming of 1.6 degrees C is the best we can hope for, and chances are not that good. Our lead author is Christoph Bertram. He is Associate Research Professor at the Center for Global Sustainability. That's at the University of Maryland. He's also a guest researcher at PIC, the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, where he worked for over a dozen years. The paper's title is Feasibility of Peak Temperature Targets in Light of Institutional Constraints. We don't find this process easy to talk about or understand. Many of us tune right out when the subject of 1.5 even comes up. We are discouraged by dozens of years of failure by the COP process, where talk is cheap and emissions keep going up. This new paper takes that on, including limitations and feasibility in the real world. From Maryland, Christoph Bertram, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Now, according to the EU Copernicus Service, the last 12 months were, quote, 1.64 degrees C above the 1850 to 1900 pre-industrial average. Christoph, why are there so many studies on 1.5 degrees of warming when it may already be in the rear view mirror?
Yeah, this is, of course, an obvious question, but the differentiation that one has to keep in mind here is that kind of last year's temperature data is not what the average temperature is referred to when we talk about targets like the 1.5 degree target. This really is adjusted for like taking the short-term variation out of the data and really using multi-year averages, because we know that the Earth's climate system has these funny patterns. For example, last year was an El Niño year, and we know that these always are much higher than the average around them. So we are not yet at 1.5 degrees Celsius on average over multi-years on this planet. So kind of what we know is that we are probably between 1.2 or 1.3 degrees Celsius. So there is still some room before we will reach the 1.5 target. And then the other, of course, important thing to keep in mind is that, and we will dive into that later on for sure, that we are not only talking about kind of the peak temperature that we want to limit climate change to, but we are also talking about returning to lower levels that are safer for us to operate our societies in.
We will get into that. Now, what did your team set out to do that is new?
So to start that, kind of, we know the Paris Agreement has these targets of limiting warming to 2 degrees and making efforts to even lowering it to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And there have been multiple scenarios in the past that showed pathways to achieving these targets. But over time, there were more and more questions from policymakers, but also from civil society actors, different companies that put into question whether or not the scenarios that kind of inform these targets are feasible. And so the first step that happened was that different research teams went out to kind of do an analysis of existing scenarios, the scenarios that had been published before, to kind of make an assessment how feasible different aspects of the transformations within these scenarios were. Nobody yet had done kind of a multi-model effort to really look at scenarios that by design take different feasibility constraints into account. And this is exactly what we did, a team of 8 different global modeling teams that tried to understand what is the difference between running our models and trying to achieve lowest possible peak temperatures just with our default setup versus with a setup that by design is supposed to mirror more realistically the real-world constraints that we have across different dimensions.
Well, let me read you a short quote from the abstract of your new paper in Nature Climate Change. Our results show that the most ambitious mitigation trajectories with updated climate information still manage to limit peak warming to below 1.6 degrees C, low overshoot, with around 50% likelihood. However, feasibility constraints, especially in the institutional dimension, decrease this maximum likelihood considerably by 5 to 45%, ending that quote. Now, there is a lot to unpack there, starting with what is low overshoot, and does that presume carbon capture and storage or something like that to get back down to 1.5?
Yeah, great question. So the low overshoot is kind of a definition that has been introduced by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, in its 2018 special report on 1.5 degree scenarios. It's the measure of where the peak temperature lies in comparison to kind of the climate goal. So like if we have a goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees C, then we talk about low overshoot as long as the peak temperature is not higher than 1.6 degrees Celsius. And you also read that quote with the probabilities. The complicating factor is that we, of course, don't have perfect knowledge of exactly how the climate system will react to anthropogenic, so human-made emissions of greenhouse gases. And this is why kind of we have to operate with these probability levels, which of course makes it a bit more difficult to talk about. And then to your second part of the question, of course, we know in order to reduce emissions after such an overshoot, so after kind of being at more elevated levels than what our long-term target is, we will need ways to reduce the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's for sure. We know there's different approaches for doing so. One, of course, is relatively natural, and planting more trees, but of course that is limited. And then other approaches for that involve using bioenergy together with carbon capture and storage that you refer to. Now, what is important in the context of our study is that we don't explicitly talk about this part after peak temperature. We really only wanted to look into the model results up to the point where the peak in global temperature is being reached. And that is, science is relatively clear on that, more or less at the point in time when the global emissions of CO2 from human activities reaches zero. So that is also often called net zero. But there is the different, the complication that sometimes people talk about net zero CO2 and sometimes about net zero greenhouse gases. I won't go into the latter, but kind of, yeah, suffice to say, for our study, the important point in time is when global CO2 emissions reach zero. If in our models we introduce the representation that not all countries share the same conditions to enact meaningful climate mitigation right from the start at maximum level, but there is a differentiation across countries, we then show that this has the implication for the maximum likelihood of staying at this low overshoot level that you quoted in your question.
So how did your study account for the many places where governments are too weak or now battered by disasters to accomplish the changes needed?
Yeah, so we don't explicitly kind of represent, of course, disasters where we also, of course, don't know where exactly they occur. We only know that for different types that they are increasing in frequency and intensity. So what we do is making use of other literature that is, of course, the basic working and principle of science, that you build on what other people have found out. There's different country specificities that determine the level to which environmental regulation can be implemented by countries. What we then do is, using the best available data for exactly these country specificities, which of course is also kind of not in that sense accurate science, because it's more about matching attributes with kind of also past observed success in, for example, also tackling acid rain and the sulfur dioxide pollution that caused that. But we can show that there, we have this huge impact on the results that I just mentioned.
And what about social resistance to change? Could you include that in a study? For example, what if religious beliefs prevent changes we need for ecological survival?
Yeah, this is clearly something we did not include in the study. This is really also what I just said with the evolving frontier of science, where we now have better understanding of kind of what different types of countries can achieve, if they have institutions in place or not. But we don't have good scientific approaches to kind of determine how the social phenomena emerge when it comes to acceptability of different solutions. So that is nothing we included in the study.
The other thing I didn't see in the study is really corporate power. If ExxonMobil was a country, its budget would be 41st among all the nations and larger than Ireland. And that's just one in a great big network of corporate wealth. Can we calculate, do you think, scenarios where fossil fuel corporations either fight to help the climate or fight against helping the climate?
That's an interesting question. And definitely there is research into exactly the influence that large corporations exert, also via research funding and different ways. And again, this is also at a level that is smaller and more fine-grained than kind of what our study operates in. So kind of our study in the models, you either have countries or even groups of countries being represented in the model as one entity. So you can't distinguish between different actors within that. And so also our study can't make statements as to kind of what the implications would be. But it's for sure that kind of the role of how also we as a society overall manage to kind of manage the transition by including the legitimate concerns of everybody involved, but also by making sure that we are not kind of captured by specific interests that don't align with the broader societal interest is a key question.
And most of our emissions don't stay in the sky. They're sucked up by the ocean and by land plants. Recently, French scientist Philippe Sieyès told us on Radio EcoShock that the land sink of plants is collapsing, his word, in this shifting climate. Oceanographers know there's a limit to carbon uptake by the sea. Should we include forecasts for reduction of natural capture in a big-picture model like yours?
Good, important to understand perhaps also is the different roles of different sets of models. So the processes regarding carbon dioxide from the atmosphere being also taken up by the oceans and then within the oceans being transported to deeper layers and the speeds of that, how that works. This is not represented in the types of models that our study worked with, which is really about the integration of the economic system with a reduced form of the climate system. So the only kind of interplay that there is exactly to the probability of how likely is it that our actions that we describe in these scenarios are then achieving staying below 1.6 degrees Celsius. So in that sense, implicitly in that uncertainty that we know we are faced with is also included a representation of the uncertainty, how exactly the oceans work going forward. So in that sense, we are taking it into account, but not in a kind of explicit way.
Christoph Bertram, did you use artificial intelligence or machine learning in this study?
A very short answer, no.
Okay. So in your estimates of carbon-based energy demand, what about artificial intelligence? If AI companies build all those $100 billion server farms, that might affect the feasibility of reaching our 1.5 or 1.6 goal?
Exactly. And this is the one case where basically, I mean, again, we are not explicitly introducing that because we don't have a disaggregation of energy use types that is that granular, that it kind of differentiates between like not even server farms versus other forms of use of electricity in commercial and service applications, which we, of course, know there's many applications. Computers are basically in both every residential building, but even more so in every commercial building in this world. There's computers and for different uses. And we do represent, of course, that all these computers require electricity to run, and they also require industry to provide the materials and so forth. So in that sense, in a reduced form, we take into account that we have all these demands. There is, of course, an uncertainty as to how will these demands evolve going forward. We kind of there's a basic coupling in the models whereby higher income, higher affluence is coupled with higher demands. And this, of course, we can, at least for countries that are catching up, we can parameterize that based on our historical analogs from countries that already are at higher incomes. But then, of course, the frontier is where will the demands go for countries that are already very high income? And their AI plays in the current debate a big role, where people argue that we could basically, from a situation of mostly saturated demands in many service categories for high income countries, AI could lead to that boost and much increased demand forecast. My take is that it's a bit early days to really be sure about. Is that something that also people, of course, talk about in order to kind of, because it's in their interest to kind of have people kind of invest into these things. Because, of course, in the end, if AI, I mean, the main premise of that is that it's a very efficient technology and really useful in saving resources. So, and only if it can do that, it also is kind of a commercial and economically viable alternative. So there is also a scenario where in the end, it actually never lives up to its promises, but then also the demands for it will also not skyrocket. But there is, of course, in between kind of a dystopian scenario that one can think about, where it basically keeps on growing and growing. Also, it actually never reaches basically the efficiency it kind of originally aspires to. And that indeed would make it harder. We did not look at such a high demand scenario explicitly, also because the ex-post studies on existing scenarios that I mentioned at the beginning were mostly pointing to the fact that the scenario space so far is not looking enough at scenarios that, on the contrary, we have a lower demand. Perhaps not going into the details here, but what we show is in that case, we call that the enabler. If you have lower demands in your system, the transformation becomes easier on the supply side.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
Why is so much of the discussion in the paper about carbon pricing instead of other all-of-society methods to save ourselves, like carbon and energy rationing, for example?
Well, the carbon price is really not meant to imply that policies never like have to be in that form, right? I mean, we also know carbon pricing itself can take different forms. Also, I think we mentioned it explicitly in some point that, of course, countries can apply and are applying a host of different types of policies, ranging from regulation to incentive structures. And the problem, of course, is if you have multiple regions within your model and you, of course, don't know about like how future implementation of these host of detailed policies will look like. So in order to just simplify the picture, this is why our models operate with this tool of the carbon pricing, the marginal abatement cost. But that really is not to imply that this should in all circumstances be the chosen policy instrument.
Well, we see how complex this is, and many things, important factors, will always have to be left out because we just don't know enough about them. So why are you and so many other scientists trying to predict climate scenarios? What is the point?
Now, that's a good question. And the first thing to note here is really that our scenario work is not meant to be a prediction. It is an exploration. And this is a very important differentiation. So the study we are talking about here perhaps is a bit of creating a false impression because it only looks at one set of scenarios that is at the lower end, right? But we are like of achievable temperature targets. But that is really because this is the research question we want to answer here, how institutional constraints and other feasibility constraints impact the lower level of achievable peak temperature the target. But more broadly, we really as a community and in the scientific literature look at a host of all different, widely differing scenarios. And with neither of them, we kind of attach a specific, this is the prediction and this is where the world is going. But on the other hand, we explicitly know that a key difference between the different scenarios and basically what will determine which way the world will go depends on decisions by humans. And not only, of course, we know that most impactful decisions are by policymakers that basically set the rules for everybody, but also corporations and even citizens basically have a role in that whole situation. Citizens, of course, also because they, in the end, are responsible for voting in governments in many parts of the world and thereby also have the impact on what political decisions will be taken. And what we are trying to provide is a good map whereby all the decision makers and societies can see, A, what does it take to get to a specific scenario that you want to kind of achieve, or B, does being also open to explore what are implications of different decisions. These two modes of decision support, I think, can scenarios contribute in a valuable way.
At the end of last year, you were lead author of a different study of interest to all of our listeners. The title is Ramping Up Methane Emissions Reductions in This Decade, Implications of Methane Emissions for a Near and Medium-Term Warming. Is methane in the atmosphere increasing? And do you find that we just can't achieve net zero with only controlling carbon dioxide emissions?
Yeah, this is really very complementary work in the sense that kind of over the past years, I and others have been working on this one study that we just talked about in Nature Climate Change, which is mostly talking about the relationship between the carbon budget until reaching net zero CO2 and temperature. But then this other work that you just referred to on methane is also crucially important. And of course, we do reference in the fine print in each of these publications the relative importance of the other one. It's just also the part of the scientific endeavor that you have to break it down into pieces to be able to make kind of a meaningful contribution. And only in broader assessments, basically, you take all the pieces together. So to your question on methane, we know it is increasing. We, on the methane question, are actually not yet able to fully understand the picture as well as with CO2, meaning that for some sources, we don't have too good data information on whether or not emissions are increasing or decreasing. A very important case in point is the oil and gas sector of the United States, which is kind of one of the largest emitting countries of methane, and it's the largest sector within that country. But the problem is with methane, other than with CO2, it's not only the activity that determines how many emissions I have, but it's crucially dependent on exactly how the activity is playing out. That might sound very abstract, so let me break it down to you. In a coal power plant, we know how much CO2 is produced by just knowing how many tons of coal went into the plant. If I operate an oil or gas supply chain where I have somewhere the oil that I take out of the ground and then use it in a car or kind of use the gas in homes or in power plants, I don't know how much CH4 emissions occur along the way, because that really depends a lot on how I manage the process. Because, of course, in both cases, the companies involved have an interest to minimize the CH4 emissions, because whatever CH4 is staying within the system can be sold as natural gas, which basically is CH4, methane. But nevertheless, it's never possible to perfectly make such that there is no leak whatsoever. And so this is why on the methane front, we are still somewhat earlier in the process of really understanding what the feasibility to fast reductions are. But we do know, and this is exactly what the study from last November was showing, that it's crucial. Without a fast reduction of absolute levels of CH4 emissions, we cannot achieve our most ambitious peak temperature targets. And then the question, what I think is conceptually important to understand, of course, also when you want to reach net zero greenhouse gases, that definitely involves also minimizing CH4 emissions, but you don't need to bring CH4 emissions, methane, to zero. And from what I just mentioned, it also becomes clear it basically would be impossible if that really was required. But we need to bring it to the lowest possible level, and that definitely will be kind of less than half of the methane that we are currently emitting. And another complication with methane, of course, also is that it's not only the energy system, but also a lot from the agricultural and livestock system that produces methane.
What are you working on now, Christoph?
Currently, we are working again on something complementary. This study on the feasibility of peak temperature targets was mostly operating at the global level, using basically a top-down approach to better understand how countries differ in their means of bringing about rapid decarbonization. What we are now doing in the current year, where also until March next year, countries are requested by the Paris Agreement process to deliver new targets for 2035, their so-called next level of nationally determined contributions, NDCs. And in that context, we try to assess on country level what are plausible pathways and target ranges that countries can aspire to, looking at kind of also what does it take for different emission levels to be reached in sectors like the electricity sector and so forth.
From the Center for Global Sustainability at the University of Maryland, we've been speaking with scientist Christoph Bertram. Find links to all the science we just talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Christoph, thank you so much for sharing time with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I may have to take the next week off due to a family health emergency. You will get a Best of Radio EcoShock special. Then it's back to new shows, I hope, marching off to the climate front, fighting without hope of victory, because we must. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for sticking with these difficult and unpleasant questions about our common future. I appreciate you listening and caring about our world. Pass it on.